Christians often think about evangelism in terms of what we say. It can easily become a formula of the right words spoken in the right way that amounts to faithfulness. And in many ways, this is an entirely appropriate way to think. However, it's also an incomplete way to think. Our witness to the world is not just with our words, but also with how we live our lives. We testify to the gospel as we live transformed lives. As we think about reaching cross-culturally with the gospel, how we live is often as important as anything else. People want to see that following Jesus is a livable way of being. And this, of course, doesn't mean that everything in life will be easy, but even in hardship, in the real cost of discipleship, we can demonstrate the goodness of God in Christ, living with real hope. Today on the podcast, we're considering the significance of the Christian life as we reach out to Hindus with the gospel. Hello and welcome to the Center for Christian Living podcast. My name is Chase Kuhn, and I'm coming to you from Moore Theological College in Sydney, Australia. I'm very excited today to be joined by two guests, which is not typical of our podcast episodes, but today a real privilege to have Clive Bulgins, who is an evangelist to Hindus and a trainer for evangelism and new churches, an organization that's serving Sydney Anglicans, as well as Ben George, who is the chair of the Satya Network, which is seeking to reach Hindus with the gospel and to help churches do the same. And Ben also works as an assistant minister at Auburn and Newington Anglican churches. I was joking with Ben about just how long his titles are, but Ben, congratulations for such a long title.
Thank you.
Great to have you gentlemen with us. Thank you very much for coming.
Great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, privilege, a real privilege. We've just come from a coffee where I've been able to hear all kinds of wonderful things about your heart for the gospel and your work amongst Hindu people here. Just help us understand the magnitude of Hinduism, where it's present and how it's coming into even more and more of the Western world, like Sydney, for example, but listeners elsewhere too. Tell us about that.
Well, you probably have heard, but India is now the most populous country in the world. So it's overtaking China. And that's reflected in the migration figures here as well. It's now the number one non-Western people group. So England is still the number one, but second is from India, and then it's China. So it's now the major migrant grouping coming to Australia from non-Western backgrounds.
Wow. And in terms of Hinduism and its presence around the world, obviously you think about India, but where else is Hinduism expressed?
Yeah, I mean, Hinduism is everywhere, basically. The British Prime Minister is of a Hindu background. When he became the Prime Minister, there was a Hindu ritual that was there. Everywhere we look, there will be Hinduism expressed in different ways. And that sort of permeates all sorts of cultures and in all sorts of countries because migration is such. And also because Indians who go out and Sri Lankans and others who go out and they go and study and they get well educated and they go to various countries. And when they do that, they take their culture with them. And Hinduism is very much tied in with culture and family. These things aren't separated. And so it's, in a sense, pervasive everywhere.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to even mention the British Prime Minister, but you can see there Hinduism right at the top of a Western nation being represented. But even for me personally, moving from North America, there was Hinduism in my town, which is quite suburban. But moving now to Australia and being in Australasia, I visited other neighboring nations, and it's amazing how many Hindus there are. I mean, I know Bali is a very prominent Hindu place, as well as Malaysia. I've been to Malaysia a few times, and there are so many Hindus in Malaysia. So fascinating to see this, and I'm so grateful that you guys are helping us today to be more aware of Hindus living among us and how we might be able to reach them for Jesus. Just tell me, what do you think most people don't know about Hindus? I mean, I suspect most of our listeners don't know a lot. Some will, but many won't. What do most people not know about Hindus?
I guess when you think of Hindus, you probably think they worship lots of different gods, but most reflective Hindus would think, well, actually they worship one god, but in many different forms. So they do believe in one supreme deity, but that deity is at root unknowable. And so he has to manifest himself in different forms.
That's fascinating because I've always been taught there's more than 30 million gods or something. I don't know. Sometimes people tell me 300 million. Sometimes people tell me three. I don't know. A lot of gods is what we hear. Yeah. But to hear that there's a single deity, manifesting himself or itself in all these different forms is really eye-opening for us. So, yeah, thank you. How does that then play out in all of these different deities? Do people understand that every time they bow before an idol or they go through a ritual, that they're always doing that unto one god? Or are they thinking about it more specific, about the specific god or the idol that's represented before them?
Yeah, I think on a practical level, they do really love a particular god. Because the supreme or the one god is unknowable, they can't really attach any personal labels to that god, whether he's just or loving or merciful. And so when they have an incarnation of a god, they're able to personally relate to that god. So it's a little bit easier to worship. So on a practical level, they do really love their favorite god.
Okay. So they're looking for something to see, something to relate to. And how does that relationship play out? Is it one of devotion, or is it one of affection, or is it one of duty, of service? What kind of relationship are people expressing to these deities?
Yeah, look, there's different ways that people try to relate to that god, but that devotion is probably the most common one. They want to feel an intimate connection with their favorite god. Others are more knowledge-based. Others are more works-based or karma-based. But yeah, devotion is quite a popular one.
Yeah, okay. Is that part of a Hindu's way of thinking about the world of fulfillment? Or what are they after when they're seeking that kind of devotion to a power?
That's a good question. I think partly they are seeking that intimate relationship, but at other times they're just seeking blessing in this life. It can be fairly transactional. So they perform rituals and prayers to try and get some kind of outcome, whether it's in their exams or in their job or their money, their finances, their relationships. So it can be fairly transactional as well. On a deeper level, they want that connection, but they don't seem to get that intimate connection. So on a practical level, it's really trying to get certain outcomes.
Yeah, thanks, Clive. I'm thinking about this in terms of our own Christian living, and we've been talking about how we can relate this to the Christian life. I mean, there's an obvious point of contrast there. When we think about the gospel, we think about grace. So we don't do anything in order to get something from God. It's because God has done something for us that we receive everything. I mean, that is a remarkable thing, but grace upsets that transactional way of living. But before we point a finger at another culture, it's fascinating how quickly I think Christians can slip back into that transactional way of living. Maybe we'll come back to that in a few minutes and explore that. On the transactional nature, I remember going to a Hindu temple in North America, actually, and asking the priest about the kinds of duties that they were doing when they go into the temple. And he talked about feeding the gods, about bathing the gods, about changing even clothes and things for the gods. So it's about this service unto the gods of doing things, I think, as you said, probably for a blessing of sorts. We look at that through biblical eyes and laugh because of the prophecies of Isaiah or other places where we see, you know, how could you carve something and do everything for your god when a god is supposed to be powerful enough to do it for themselves. How do Hindus understand what they're doing?
I think partly it is out of that devotion. They'll think, I want to be faithful to my God. If they haven't been to the temple for a while, they'll feel that kind of spiritual urge. I need to go and do something for my God. So partly it's transactional, but it's also partly their conscience. They're thinking, oh, I need to somehow serve my God. And so they go and offer things in order to honor their God.
Yeah, fascinating, fascinating. So it's one, not just because they're thinking their God is powerless, but actually one of service to the God in devotion. Does it ever register for them, you think, that they are doing something that the God can't do for themselves?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. What do you think, Ben?
I guess the key thing undergirding all of this is the transactional nature. So even if there was something like that, it's too risky to question God about something like that. And so the thing to do is to do whatever it takes to make sure that they get whatever is needed for that particular. And we're not always just thinking transactional, as in thinking of an exam and passing an exam. In the more extreme cases, we were talking a bit earlier about in regional parts of India, it may be the case that a family has 5 or 6 children and they don't have enough to feed that family. And so they will sacrifice the first child to the temple to be a worker in that temple and never see them again, in order to make sure the other 5 children are able to then eat.
Yeah.
In that sort of transactional nature, because the transactions are based on fear and desperation and need, even if there is what can seem to us like a very obvious contradiction or a very obvious breaking of some kind of logic, it's too risky to go down that path of questioning those things. because it could just make things worse and worse and worse, especially if karma is right.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So that kind of transactional way of thinking is really enslaving to people, because once you're in a system where I must do something in order to get, if you break out of that system, there's always that fear crouching at your door that if I don't do that, if I actually give up on the system, I may actually go without. And so it locks people into a way of living and being, which is, I think, something really fascinating for us as we think about reaching people with the gospel. Mm-hmm. How do we see real freedom come to them as they receive grace? And what kinds of hurdles are present to people as they break out of that? I mean, just talk about that for a minute. When you present the gospel to somebody from a Hindu background, how do you help them get loose of superstition or fear?
I just think it takes a long time. I think people need to hear grace so many times before it actually sinks in. And even if Hindu background people do come to Christ, they will still have that in the back of their mind. You know, if they go through some sickness, they'll think, oh, is Christ upset with me? Or it's very hard to remove that karmic idea of retribution or cause and effect from even their Christian lives. And to be honest, I think a lot of Christians struggle with this too sometimes. You know, why is God doing this? What have I done to deserve this? But for Hindu background, maybe it's even more ingrained. Mm-hmm. And so to keep hearing grace, it just, you know, it's so wonderful that we forget it even as believers. Mm-hmm. And so we just keep reminding them how much Jesus loves them and what he's done for them and that he's with them. And it's a beautiful thing.
That is a beautiful thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's a great thing for us to keep remembering how important it is to live by faith in that grace over and over again, that even as Christians, as we encounter difficulty, standing fast in faith that God is good, that God is faithful, even when we feel pain or sorrow or suffering, which we'll come back to in a minute as we think about witnessing to Hindus. Just thinking about differences as well in culture, I'd love to hear about morality for Hindus. What is it that drives the Hindu moral way of life? What do they think about in terms of right and wrong and how they ought to be living in this world?
I guess to start with, one key thing is that morality is very much attached to society, to the family structure. And so understanding right and wrong is right and wrong in the context of relationships, whether that's family or the bigger structure. And so when I make a decision that I know will either positively or negatively impact family, impact, if I had a sister, it would be impacting the sister's potential marriage in the future in terms of society, whether that brings shame to the family and to the society or not. And so morality then is very much tied into everything else that is around. And so in one sense, the objective right and wrong of morality that comes from a particular book or understanding the truth about God is really not the thing that is there. The thing that is there really that everyone is understanding and everyone is using as their worldview is that in all of society, morality is based on whether or not we are good or bad for that society and the good or badness of that society.
Yeah, that is such a clash with Western ways of thinking. I mean, to totally take it out of this context for a moment of thinking about Hindus, I had friends that were in Africa recently for a conference, and they were just mentioning how they were talking about Western understanding and secularism, and the African brothers and sisters that were listening were open mouth, jaw to the floor. How could somebody think like that? How could somebody be so individualistic? I mean, it was really a shock to them. So as we maybe think about encountering Hindus and talking to them about the gospel and even about morality, how do we work to understand more of that communal mindset that maybe helps us to be aware of some of our own blind spots, but also to translate, if you will, the gospel into that context as a way of reaching people that are more community-minded? How do you encourage people to think differently in that way?
I guess one thing to do is to think about everything in the context of community. Actually, as churches, we may be saved individually, but saved into a community and into a family. And so that's the type of thing we really want to display for our friends from a Hindu background, because it will help them to see the reality that we're not taking them away from their family in order to be a random individual that has to somehow tough it out just with God alone. Actually, it's with God alone and the blessing of all these brothers and sisters that we have. And that's a challenge for us, at least in Sydney, that's a challenge for us, because it means more time, an investment of more time, not just at church and after church, but also an investment in time getting involved in the messiness of each other's family, because that's what it's like. In most South Asian background gatherings, you pass your child on to the other 180 aunties that are there because they're all part of the family and the child knows all of them and they know the child and that's normal. And then all the kids sleep in a pile on the side when it's 11 p.m. and all the adults are doing something. That's an expected norm. And so to be able to do that as churches, to show that we're living lives and we're living lives as families together is really helpful, because actually that's the biblical gospel way of life.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? I find that so helpful, Ben, and so frightening at the same time, because as a Westerner, I mean, I wonder what the listeners are thinking about in terms of, you know, oh, that sounds really good, or oh, that sounds terrifying to me that I have to open my life up to so many people and have responsibility. We've become so accustomed in the West to living our lives as we choose, on our own time, in our own way, that it just sounds inconvenient to involve more people. Mm-hmm. And personally, when I think about people being involved in my life, I think about more mess being involved in my life, mm-hmm. because people used to say more money, more problems. I think more people, more problems. You know, that's just the way life works. Yeah. But you're right, Ben. There is actually a real blind spot for us in Western cultures where we can think about just me and Jesus, and even church, it's about just me and my experience getting what I want. When actually, no, we're not saved unto things that I want. We're actually saved unto belonging to a people, a new people, mm-hmm. from one people to another people. And that's something rich and wonderful and hard and beautiful and all that. Mm-hmm. And we really need to maybe transform our way of thinking about how we could be more countercultural today, even in Western mm-hmm. churches, which might actually, one, make us more biblically faithful, but two, make us a better landing place for people that are converting from other cultures, which, yeah, is really great. Thank you, Ben. Yeah.
In one sense, we are already on the back foot because Hinduism is so tied in with culture. So just take Indians as an example. Hinduism and Indian culture and all the forms that that takes, they are inseparable. They go together. And so then the assumption is that Christianity and Western culture are all one as well. And so when they see Western culture and they think, well, that's what Christians do. And so being able to show something different to that, to show being a follower of Jesus and living in a way that is actually good and other person-centered and actually taking into account not just your immediate family, but also a very large, sometimes church family, those things suddenly help people to see, oh, that's not what we thought. It's different from that. And maybe these people are actually trying to follow this Jesus who they say is King and Lord and God.
Yeah.
And that just as an experiential thing or as an example that we can show is actually very helpful for people to think outside the box.
That's great. And it is a real wake-up call too for us about the ways that our faith has been so enculturated. Mm. So you're right. Mm. I mean, you think about it, an Indian person thinks Christianity is just Western. So they turn on the TV and they assume Christian, which is shocking, because most Christians think, no, that's not us. Mm-hmm. But you do wonder when people come to church how different that experience is, and what they're told, how different it is, or the lives that the people live, how different they are than what the rest of the culture is doing or saying is true.
Mm-hmm. And are we displaying real communal life together? I guess Western individualism and efficiency often dictates what we do on a Sunday. Like, if the service goes for more than an hour and 15 minutes, we're like, oh, we got to get out of here.
Yeah.
Rather than, are we sharing our lives together? Are we having meals together? Are we inviting people into our homes or into our gatherings? Are we really displaying the communal life that Christ calls us to live and the body that Christ has made us to be?
Yeah, that's really helpful. Take a break from our program, I'd like to tell you about some resources for your Christian life. First, we have some very significant events coming up with the Center for Christian Living. On Wednesday, June 7th, we'll be hosting Professor David Van Drunen of Westminster Seminary, California, for two evening events. We'll begin from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. with a public lecture on the glory of true humility. And then after a break for dinner, where in-person guests are welcome to roam up King Street for some delicious eats, we'll come back to our CCL series event
from 7:30 to 9 p.m. on the topic of virtue in an age of virtue signaling. I really hope that you'll prioritize joining us in person or on the live stream for these events. And as a reminder, we host these events on Wednesday nights so that church Bible study groups can participate together. We'd love to have you or your whole group join us, and these events continue to be by donation only. So come whether you can give or not. All the details can be found under the events tab on our website, ccl.more.edu.au. I really hope that you'll register and plan to join us. Second, for those of you who are interested in learning more about reaching Hindus for Christ, there are some ways that you can benefit from the ministry of Ben and Clive, our guests today. If you're in Sydney or you're able to be here on August 19th, consider coming along to the Satya Conference. There are some significant guest speakers that day, including the Archbishop of Sydney, Kanishka Raffle. You also might like to consider reaching out to Clive about church consultations, where he offers to help congregations better be equipped to reach Southeast Asians. You can find out details of the conference and how to be in touch with Clive on the Satya Network website, satyanetwork.org. That's S-A-T-Y-A network.org. Now let's get back to our program.
How do Hindus then think about morality in Christianity? I mean, you've talked about this, Ben, about the ways that maybe they might look onto Westerners and assume they're Christian. How do Hindus think about Christian morality?
Yeah, I mean, I think in one sense, individuals will be different. But just generally speaking, I think one of the problems is that when Hindus think about Christianity and Christian morality, they often look at this type of things that we say and then the type of things that we do and see a mismatch there between our worldview and our practice. And so I think they think this all sounds very good, but given inherently they are pluralistic in nature in terms of their thinking, what it means is they think, well, that's one way of doing it that could be good, and this is another way of doing it that could be good. And they're not really seeing that this is the way that we think is the best way to live.
Yeah.
Because what they're seeing is that, well, Christians have all these things where we should be loving and other person-centered towards people. But how that translates is when I need to meet with you, well, I'll schedule a coffee that goes for no more than 45 minutes because I need to go see someone else. There has been no Indian friend of mine that I've ever met with that has gone for less than 45 minutes. It doesn't happen. Because time and really listening to the other person and really enjoying a meal together with the other person and sharing with each other is part of what it means to be good and to invite this person into your life. And so we just need to be mindful of those things. It doesn't mean now we need to schedule all meetings to be 3 hours long. It just means we need to be mindful of the reality that we say we want to be other person-centered. We say that that's what it means to adorn the gospel and follow Jesus. But that's not necessarily how we act in terms of the practical things we do on a daily basis.
Yeah. Real care for real people. That's, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And so we may have a good view of right and wrong, and they may see that come out in particular things. But also those good, strong views of right and wrong that then hurt other people in the sense that they contradict what other people think. Well, that's something that is really very difficult to fathom when you have a very, very large gathering where everybody needs to be able to mix together with all their different views and thoughts and everything else. And so that also feels like, oh, this is going to break the community and this is going to be shameful to the community to think something different from everyone else. And so all of these things then, I think from a Hindu perspective sometimes, come off as a contradiction unless we sort of walk alongside them and show them in the daily life of a Christian what it looks like to live these things out.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah. I think it's so easy for us to make so much of what we say that the only thing that matters is that I can say the right words, that it's the gospel articulated in just the right terms that is going to be the effective witness to my neighbor. But actually, you've just helped us to see that there's a really crucial component of deeds, that actually living according to the truth really testifies to the goodness of that truth, which then probably enables a conversation about that truth as well. So it's not that it's just word, no deeds. It's not just that it's just deeds, no words, but it's actually really both, that they both really matter. And so the Christian life and our morality must shine forth, if you will, in that goodness of the gospel, which I think is what 1 Peter 2 talks about. So really, really helpful. So as you begin to have conversations with somebody from a Hindu background, where do you start? Clive, you're doing this work right now. You're consulting with churches on how to better reach Hindus. How do you start there? What do you do as you begin to engage Hindus with the gospel?
Yeah, so I think what you were talking about in terms of word and deed is really important. So for Hindus, propositional ideas are not as powerful as the experience of what they're believing. So Hindus generally don't follow their gods because they're convinced of a particular doctrinal truth. They follow because of experience. I remember getting on a bus and meeting a guy who had just come from the temple. And I said, oh, do you always go to this temple? He said, oh, no, I grew up worshipping a different god, but didn't seem to work out for me. And then I came here and prayed to this god and it seemed to answer my prayer. So now I come here. So nothing to do with the ideas or the doctrine, but simply the experience. And so often when we think about how to share Jesus and share our lives, we think about how do we engage the ideas? Whereas for them, the experience of Jesus as a true and living God, a God who walks with us, changes our lives, is more powerful and more relevant. So I think similar to what Ben said, we need to think about how do we live authentic lives trying to follow Jesus? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be all successful, like everything that we say we do, but in our successes and our failures, do we rely on Jesus? When we fail morally, do we say, Lord, I'm sorry for what I've done and I admit what I've done, and yet thank you for your grace. And so we're showing a different way to live that's actually gospel-centered.
Yeah, and how do we persuade people then? I mean, on that really important point you just raised, if someone's going to jump ship because one God isn't working for them, the call of the Christian life is not to come and have abundance. It's actually to come and die. That if you lose your life, you'll find it. And there's so much promise for us that actually in giving up everything, we'll receive everything. But the everything we receive isn't necessarily bliss today. It might be more suffering and hardship today. And so how, when you're trying to break people free from, if I do this, then I'll get that. If you come and follow Jesus, what you're going to get is perhaps suffering now, but it's worth it. How do you persuade people there?
Yeah, I think prayer is the most important thing. So encouraging people to pray to Jesus. Hindus are very happy to add Jesus to the 300 million gods. But as they get to know Jesus, they'll see that he's a true and living God. And he may not answer their prayers the way they want. He may heal them or answer their prayers in different ways, but he may also just reveal himself personally. And they'll realize, actually, this is more than the transactional religion I've come from. This is a God who loves me and wants to have a relationship with me and offers me eternal life. And that is far greater than what I thought I was coming to get.
Isn't that lovely? And it's the thing that you said that they're after. They want a God they can know.
Yeah.
And ultimately the God that they say they worship, that manifests themselves in all these different ways, has to do so because he's unknowable. But actually our God is known and makes himself known and relatable and caring, and he shows us so much of himself.
There's a wonderful book called Found by Love by an ex-Hindu priest. And he was following the devotional path, poured out his heart to his favorite god of singing songs and prayers and rituals. And yet he hardly felt like there was love coming back the other way.
Wow.
And one day he was in an airport and he started reading a children's Bible in a bookstore and realized, hey, this is a God who really loves me and wants to know me. And he started reading more of the Bible and started following Jesus in a secret way, and even started putting some of those biblical truths into his public Hindu talks.
Wow.
And the hearers were like, wow, this is amazing. Where are you getting this stuff from?
Fantastic.
And eventually he had to admit to his guru that I'm going to be following Jesus. Yeah, it's quite an amazing story.
What a lovely testimony.
Yeah.
Which incidentally is why stories are so powerful, including stories from the gospel. So just pick any story of Jesus interacting with someone, and all of that is mind-blowing. You know, God himself not only interacting with people, but not in that sort of transactional way. Like, these people have nothing they can give him, and yet he goes to them. He goes to the women who are vulnerable. He goes to the people who are possessed by demons. He goes to all these people who are suffering and in strife and crying out. And he goes, and not only does he help them with that immediate issue, but then he calls them to follow him. Like, that's unbelievable. That's going to change everything that they thought they knew about what it's like to relate to God in any way. And that already is such a big thing. And I think of this concept called the God shelf, right? And so you think about the God shelf and you think, well, Hindus, let's say hypothetically, they have 100 gods on their God shelf, 100 idols. And there's an experience that means that now they think Jesus should be on that God shelf because we prayed once and now the car's working and that's awesome. So Jesus is now God number 101 on that God shelf. And then actually the next 3 years, it's the experiences that come with discipleship. As we mentor, as we invite them into our family times, as we do prayer time with them, as we read the Bible with them, as we interact with them when we are struggling or when they are struggling, as we're willing to go out of our way, all of those things mean that over a 3, 5, 10, 15 year period, those other 100 gods come off the shelf one by one. Because Shiva doesn't do this for me, Hanuman doesn't do this for me, Ganesh doesn't do this for me. And it's not only that Jesus does this for me, he's with me all the time, but also all of the other people who Jesus is with all the time, they also are surrounding me and loving me and caring for me in a way that tries to model what Jesus is doing, even if it's not perfect.
Mm.
That's profoundly powerful. Like,
yeah.
And so over time, that's the way I like to think about the Hindu experience, is that discipleship really matters. Now, that doesn't mean we don't do the evangelistic course, and that doesn't mean we don't do the evangelistic call at the end of preaching, and that doesn't mean we don't do all these other things. But often those things are either a step in the lifespan of discipleship with a Hindu person, where either they have been talking to somebody for a long time and then they finally get hit by it, or they get hit by it and then now it needs to be what happens next to show what it looks like to live as a Christian. But either way, it can't just be one or the other. It's surely got to be both. And I think that's true of everybody, even not from a Hindu background.
Yeah.
But it's very much the way that they understand things from their worldview and mindset. Because why would you leave all of these family connections and these people who will pick up your kids from school and babysit you and do all this sort of stuff? Why would you leave all of that for something individualistic where even the people that you can see who also are followers of Jesus don't really do that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And, you know, I think that's a real lesson for us, Ben, that we've become so accustomed to this individual crisis-based evangelism. There's an event. I call you to a response. You must respond now or else. And in one sense, you want to say, yes, that's true. That's the call of life every day. Do you repent and believe? But actually, we've got to understand that sometimes there is a process of people coming to the gospel, and that actually we need to be patient in that process as people are, in one sense, invited to taste and see that the Lord is good. Mm-hmm. And may the Lord clear the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
May he make it clear to them that he alone is the Lord, that there is no other, and that his glory will not be shared. But sometimes it takes a little time for people to see that as they begin to journey and taste and see. Brothers, I'm so grateful for the work you're doing. Ben, Clive, it's been such a joy to hear a bit about your ministry and about how we can be thinking differently. And I really hope that people today have been encouraged to think differently just about how we might be prone towards our own individualism and ways that that might actually be a barrier to people coming to Christ. So may we actually prayerfully consider how we can reach others, especially Hindus, with the gospel. Thank you, brothers, very much.
Thanks.
Thanks so much, Chase.
To benefit from more resources from the Center for Christian Living, please visit ccl.more.edu.au, where you'll find a host of resources, including past podcast episodes, videos from our live events, and articles published through the center. We'd love for you to subscribe to our podcast and for you to leave us a review so more people can discover our resources. On our website, we also have an opportunity for you to make a tax-deductible donation to support the ongoing work of the center. We always benefit from receiving questions and feedback from our listeners, so if you'd like to get in touch, you can email us at ccl@more.edu.au. As always, I would like to thank More College for its support of the Center for Christian Living, and to thank my assistant Karen Bielhartz for her work in editing and transcribing the episodes. The music for our podcast was generously provided by James West.